History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take a little initiative, to ask a few questions, to invest the time, to patiently listen as memories which have been buried for decades take on new life in the here and now. Ultimately, our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really do end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today's going to be a special episode focused around an infamous incident in World War II that was unfolding 81 years ago this weekend in the Philippines. And even after all those years, while we know it was awful, we know it was tragic, we know in so many cases inhumane, but what we don't know is just how deadly the Bataan Death March was. Or maybe to put it more clearly, because of differing estimates, we still don't know just how many died in the forced march of thousands of American and Filipino prisoners, which began on April 9, 1942. Low estimates suggest 5,000 Filipinos died on the 65-mile march. On the high side, some say as many as 18,000. We do know that at the very least 500 Americans died on the march, and many more would die in captivity after making it through that ordeal. Some news reports over the last year have suggested that no more survivors of the march are still with us today. But there is evidence of at least one. Last month, when the annual Bataan Memorial March was held at White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico, the first time in 3 years it's taken place in person at that location because of the pandemic, 103-year-old Valdemar de Herrera was on hand. He is now thought to be the last living American serviceman who survived the Bataan Death March. Perhaps I'll have the privilege of catching up with him the next time I'm in the Land of Enchantment, where you can find Bataan Death March memorials in multiple locations, given the fact that there were more men from New Mexico on the march than from any other state. Again, the overall numerical details remain fuzzy, but some estimates say as many as 80,000 American and Filipino troops were on the death march when it began. Someday, very soon, clearly, we're going to mark an anniversary like this in which no survivors remain. That makes sharing the stories of these men all the more important, and we're going to hear some of those memories that echo from beyond the grave today. Some of this audio, I want to caution you, is from many, many years ago, and the quality may not be as crisp as what we're used to, but what I hope is that the substance of what they shared with us will make it worth your time on this 81st anniversary. We're going to start with Wild Bill Begley. He was a 20-year-old radio operator from Kentucky who had gone to the Philippines with the 34th Pursuit Squadron. Like many others, he was pressed into infantry duty after the Japanese landed at virtually the same time as they hit Pearl Harbor. And Wild Bill would learn to do absolutely anything it would take to survive.
We had a saying, if it moves, eat it. If it stands still, we salute it. We ate monkeys and snakes, lizards, anything that walked, crawled, or flew, we ate. We were starving, actually. We ran out of food whenever General MacArthur sent word by General King for us to surrender. We didn't want to, none of us did, but that was the orders of the day. And we stacked up our rifles and went out to the road. And there's where the real terrible things happen. I was already in bad shape. I went from 180 pounds to about 110 approximately, and the reason is we didn't have any food, and like I said, if it moved, eat it. If it stood still, we always said salute it.
And but then once you're on the march, you don't even have the opportunity to do that. If you get out of line, even if you stop to get a drink of water, you might get shot, you might get bayoneted, you might get decapitated. You saw all of those things happen, didn't you?
Yes, unfortunately, I witnessed all of that kind of stuff. I walked approximately about 100 miles, I suppose. It was a terrible ordeal because they didn't give us any rest. We couldn't get any water. I went on the march, I was on it about 10 days approximately, and I didn't get any food, didn't get any water. Guys would drop out, and they'd try to help one another, and it was pitiful. If you stopped, they'd either shoot or bayonet you. They got so they seemed to enjoy bayoneting more than anything else. The thing about it is they also got some women and children, unfortunately, and they wouldn't let them out. They finally did. Quite a few of the Philippine soldiers, they slipped off into the forest, and if they got caught, they'd get shot if they are bayoneted. So you had to be careful. We stopped at one place, I think it was the town of San Fernando. They lectured us in Japanese. They had an interpreter that would tell us what he's saying. They said you'd be shot and you'd be bayoneted. You had to do what they wanted to. And if you dared to get off the road, see a dirty ditch full of filthy water, a lot of guys would be desperate and they'd make a break for it, and they'd shoot them and bayonet them. It was pretty horrible. Later, when we made a stop, there's a bunch of Japanese officers who were drinking and enjoying themselves, and they'd taunt us. We did get to sit down. And every now and then they'd pick out 10 men, make them dig a hole in the ground. They would use their two-handed samurai sword, and they tried to first see if they could decapitate a guy with one lick.
And this is a living person standing in this hole they dug.
Yeah, they'd make you come to attention, and they'd walk away. Mm. Then later, they got tired of that because they got blood all over their uniforms and their equipment. So they decided to change it, and they lined us up about 10 again. You dig a hole, and then they'd come around behind and shoot you in the back of the head. You'd fall in.
Mm.
That went on until they got tired. We walked day and night, no food, no water. It's a terrible ordeal. I remember in particular two incidents that still come to mind. There's a lady, we went through a little barrio, they call that a town. She had a little boy about 3 years old. The thing about it was he stuck his finger up and said, V for victory. When he did, a Japanese guard happened to be close by, and he bayoneted the little feller. Mm. And he raised him up, and he tried to fling him off his bayonet, and his mother screamed. She ran out there and she tried to cover him, and a guard bayoneted her, and she died right there. And one other particular incident that was kind of bad was two chaplains were going across the bridge along with the rest of us. And one of them decided, well, this is too much, and he jumped. And the other chaplain ran around and tried to get to him. And when he did, the guard motioned him back and didn't want to get to him, but he insisted. So he shot him, and then he bayoneted him. They died holding hands.
Hmm. Unbelievably horrific things that you witnessed, and I know that you endured too. I know that you estimate you were bayoneted yourself 30 times, you were wounded 5 times in the war. After the march was over, you were still a prisoner of war for another 3.5 years before you were liberated, wasting away to 68 pounds by the time you were liberated, from 180 to 68, if you're listening at home and can just imagine what that must be like. I know it's the obvious answer to the question, did you ever think you were going to die, was yes. You probably had to think about that every day. But what was it that kept you going and that kept you believing that you might be able to make it home and marry and have a family and have the kind of life that you were fighting to preserve?
Well, I didn't have no fancy thoughts about marrying or anything like that. I worried whether or not I'd ever get through and survive. That was the main consideration. And under the circumstances, it was a pretty hard row. You wonder what made me keep going and whatnot. Well, later on, we got into some barracks and whatnot. I seen guys actually more or less commit suicide because they couldn't take it until they picked us up and sent us by ship to Mukden, Manchuria. There we got a little better consideration because they put us in the tool and die factory where they made the tools for machinery or plane parts or anything. Everybody, 100% of us, sabotaged everything. And they had guards right over us, and we'd put filings in the oil and all kinds of stuff.
There was one more thought that Bill shared when I asked him why he spent decades traveling up and down California as part of a military honor guard for countless burials of veterans.
Well, when we got to O'Donnell, the first prisoner of war camp, the guys were dying so fast, it was terrible. The ones that were standing and able to walk and carry somebody, we'd get a door off of a hut, and four of us get on it many times before we got to the hole in the ground where we'd have to throw them in there. Maybe half of the guys, and I've seen as many as four of the stretcher bearers, would die en route. Mm. It was pretty tough.
It is just unbelievable to imagine how these courageous men persevered amidst those conditions. But every Death March survivor I've talked to echoes a similar storyline. And that includes those from New Mexico, which had more men on the march than any other state in the Union. One of them was a man named Julio Barella. And even before the march started, things had gotten pretty bleak for Julio. He and his fellow members of the 200th Coast Artillery in the Philippines were undersupplied, ill-equipped, and had no hope of reinforcements.
We don't surrender until we run out of everything. We were starving, eating weeds and stuff like that in order to survive. And there's where the death march started.
Now, when you started that march, you had no idea how long it was going to go. And you're already starving, right?
We started that death march pretty weak. We were pretty weak then because when we were fighting, we didn't have enough to eat. First thing, we were getting only two meals a day, and then they cut us to one meal a day. And then after that, we didn't have anything to eat. So,
what kept you going? How did you continue on? Because I'm sure a lot of guys were falling by the side and probably getting shot or bayoneted, and you were seeing guys fall left and right. What kept you going? How do you think you survived?
To survive? Well, we used to hunt, we used to eat weeds and stuff like that. Then a lot of them died with malaria, and a lot of them with diarrhea, according to what they eat, see. And part of them died in the death march, and then the other part died in concentration camp.
Did you ever think that you were going to die?
I thought I was going to die, but I just got to where I didn't care. It was just like this. See, I used to worry a lot about my folks, about my mother. I used to worry every day. And one day I said to myself, "Why hell, I'm nothing but a doggone stupid. I'm not going to worry about them because they're better off than I am. They're not having as much trouble as I am having." And the other boys, they feel the same way. We got to where we forgot all about our folks and about the living life. Maybe we were just lucky because when they surrendered, a lot of them died of starvation. A lot of them, they didn't have anything to eat. They were weak, malaria, dysentery, and all that. A lot of disease. Well, we got to where we didn't care. We used to help the ones that couldn't walk. By the Japanese, the ones that couldn't walk, they shoot them. When a man lay down and he can't get up, why, they shoot him. So if they were punish you when you were in concentration camp, they punished me and they knocked me down. And then I have in mind that if I try to stand up and get up, I won't to kill. So, see, that's a lesson the hard way.
I'll say that's a great way to put it, learning the hard way indeed. And every survivor of the death march that I've interviewed over the years has told me really the same thing that you just did. No one knows exactly how many people died on the march. I've seen estimates of around 10,000 or so. And who knows how many died later because of what they went through on the march. But I know that you Americans helped each other, and you got a lot of help from the Filipinos, who, from what I've seen, statistically outnumbered Americans on the march about 7-1. But all of you were not only marching 61 miles through deep layers of dust, you really didn't have any kind of nourishment. How bad was it? How bad in terms of what you had to eat and drink?
They make us wait 3 days before they could start giving us a bowl of rice, just how much they can grab on a bowl full of rice. And that's when the death march starts. They start walking without water. And then in concentration camps, we were there starving all the time that we were in prison camp. We never did get anything much to eat. And they were Filipinos that they would try to help us, give us food. They find out that Filipino tried to help POWs. They would shoot them, burn their kids, burn their homes. They act like they were not civilized. We never have a dream that we was going to survive. We didn't, never thought we was going to make it.
Do you remember how much you weighed before?
I weighed about 145, 150. I never been very heavy. But when I was liberated, I weighed 83 pounds.
Your liberation. You survived the march to Camp O'Donnell. You'd been in another infamous camp at Cabanatuan. They took you over to Japan on a hell ship. And in late August of 1945, the atomic bombs had been dropped. The war was coming to an end. And finally, your camp at Niigata, Japan, was liberated. What do you remember about that? What do you remember about tasting freedom again for the first time in more than 3.5 years?
We're very, very weak. Our mind was very weak, and our bodies very weak. We couldn't hardly do much work. We just hope and pray that someday the war will be over. We were working in a foundry. They never gave us a day off, so we noticed that it was a surprise to us that the Japanese said that we were going to get 3 days off, that we have to stay in camp. So we were anxious to hear the Japanese commander telling us that we have surrendered. And the American officer asked the Japanese, what happened? Nothing. You people won the war. The war is over. Now you people take over tonight. What the Japanese told the American commander, you take care of your prisoners, not to go out because they're going to get killed, because the Japanese don't like the American prisoners, and they're going to get killed if they go out of the camp. So better stay in the camp, so we stay there, you know, until the next day. And then the next day, they go three planes, and they drop us leaflets, saying that if we would clear the area, they will drop packages.
So they dropped some leaflets. They said, get out of the way. We don't want to kill you with the food we want to drop for you. And then you finally got to go outside of the walls of that camp. You'd been living in, I would imagine, and you've described what would be a bleak, seemingly hopeless world for so long, only praying that you'd make it out alive. So not to be too cliched, but did it feel like a dream come true or a prayer answered when you got to come home? What did that feel like?
Well, we had plenty to eat. Every place we go, we just give us something to eat and stuff like that. And it was pretty hard to tell the whole story about it. And, I don't know, and some people, well, the prisoners of war I have talked to, they feel the same way that I feel. They didn't want to talk about it. They got to where they didn't want to talk about it. That's funny. We do more talking now than we did before. We never did say anything because everywhere we go, we start asking us how many Japanese did we kill and all that. None.
Let me ask you this. How often do you think about the other prisoners of war who didn't get to come home. Do you ever think about that, about all the guys who died over there?
I dream more about them than I dream about my people, even today. Every day I remember about some of the prisoners.
Do you ever think that could have been you? Do you ever think about that, you know, how you could have died there?
Yeah, surprises me that I made it. I sometimes don't even believe it. Being so long and I've getting old and all that, I sometimes don't believe it. I don't believe it. I went through all that.
The late Julio Barrela, who was one of more than 1,800 soldiers from the state of New Mexico who endured the Bataan Death March. Only half of them would make it home at the end of the war. If you're ever in Las Cruces, it is home to what might be the most moving memorial I've ever seen, a statue of two men on the march helping another who was not strong enough to continue, with the concrete in front of and behind that statue bearing the footprints and shoe prints cast from actual Bataan survivors. On my last trip to Albuquerque, I again visited Bataan Memorial Park, where during the war, locals would gather to share updates they had heard from March survivors riding home from prison camp. It's time for our first break, but we'll hear more survivor stories when this special edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.